So I just came back from teaching a two-week retreat at Spirit Rock. It ended on Friday. And so I'm still actually quite filled by the retreat. And so the only thing I could think of talking about today was retreats. And talking about the retreat experience a little bit, and what it's like to be a retreatant, and also maybe a little bit from the point of view of a teacher. How many of you have been on a residential retreat where you go off and stay at a retreat center? And maybe half of you have done it. So maybe you know all this. But they're really marvelous, and I've done many, many, many retreats and taught many retreats, and I'm still deeply moved by the whole experience. One of the things that moves me about it is that the degree of sincerity which is expressed. People don't often feel that when individuals are in the middle of the retreat. Sometimes it can be quite difficult and struggles, and they don't feel like they're getting very concentrated, or they don't feel like they're dealing very well with what's happened or whatever. But the very idea to sit still and try to be mindful of what's happening with oneself, inside oneself, really calls forth the best in everyone. And so I sit there getting to know all these people who are really trying, bringing the best of what they have inside of them to meet themselves. And it's very rare in our culture that you get a chance to meet people, so many people at once, for whom some of the best qualities they have are coming to the forefront. So during the retreat, I'll have interviews with people. And the interviews, this retreat I saw maybe about 8, 9 people, 10 people a day. And I know when I was a retreatant, I didn't feel like I was anything special. I was struggling, and I thought I was a kind of maybe a poor meditator, not doing very well, and sometimes embarrassed to go talk to a teacher and tell a teacher what was going on with me. But as a teacher on the receiving end of it, it's just really astounding to be able to be there. And one person after another, 10 people or so, one after the other, coming and being really honest and really open and expressing themselves deeply what's going on with them, even though it's a struggle. It's kind of like, if any of you have know about the kind of the Hindu system of darshan, where you go and hang out with a teacher to get darshan from the teacher to kind of I feel like it's darshan. I'm the one who's going for darshan, because I'm sitting there getting all this purity, all this beautiful intention one after the other, in a way that is very rare in normal life. So the retreat experience does a number of things, but for one thing, it kind of belongs to a category of activity that most cultures have, but usually take people outside of the normal social relationships and activities. The idea of going, 40 days in the desert, or going off into the and being in solitude in nature for a while, or a vision quest, as they talk about here in the West, in the Americas. There's a lot of things that people do that are very, very important part of cultures. And maybe very few people in the culture will do some of these things, but they provide a kind of renewal and a kind of insight and perspective on oneself, on one's society and culture, that is incomparable. And the retreat experience, going off on retreat, whether it's 10 days or 2 weeks or 6 weeks or 3 months or however long it is, belongs to that category of actually going off into the desert for 40 days to confront yourself and meet yourself and meet your demons and meet your angels, or whatever they talk about in the Western tradition. We don't often talk about it in that way. And for many people who've been involved in the insight or Buddhist circles in America for quite some time, it just seems like it's part of what you do. It's part of the culture. It's like a normal thing. And Spirit Rock is in Marin County. It's a beautiful, some people would say beautiful upper class retreat center. And just, all these upper class people go there or whatever. And it's not the case, actually, but just kind of seems to just kind of this milieu of kind of just part of our stereotypic West Coast culture. But actually, regardless of what you think of the buildings and the place, any attempt to be in silence for 2 weeks or 1 week or 3 days or whatever, and to really be with oneself and discover oneself, is a phenomenal undertaking. So at the end of the retreat, Friday, I talked about the great courage that I felt that everyone had who had been there, stayed there for 2 weeks. And most people, you know, maybe didn't associate the word courage with their activities on the retreat. But I think that to sustain, maintain one's momentum, to stay in the retreat and meet oneself and stay present for all the varied things that might occur, and not to give up and run away, not to go home, requires a very high level of courage for many people. So it's not a lightweight thing to do. It's actually a very powerful thing to do. And if those of you who've been on retreat probably have a sense of how powerful it is. Retreats do a number of things. On the surface, they're kind of a way of de-stressing. There's a lot of people in our culture who are highly stressed. Our culture itself is stress-producing, oftentimes. And so people's jobs and activities and the kind of consumer pressure, the kind of pressure to get ahead, the kind of pressure to do a lot. Many people have commented on how much things have changed in even 20, 30, 40 years and the amount of pressure that people seem to have on them. And going on retreat is a wonderful way to begin to de-stress, take some of that pressure off. Because in the retreat, you don't have to perform. You don't have to, you don't have to, be an efficient worker. There's very little you have to actually do on retreat except sit on your cushion and walk back and forth. And so in that simplicity, you don't have to talk to anybody, hardly. You talk a little bit to the teachers every other day. So there's very little of the normal social pressures that are on people. And so it gives people an opportunity not just simply have a relief from the immediate pressures, but to begin to unwind and unravel and discover who they are. And this is a very important function of retreats, is this aspect of discovery, of revealing to ourselves who we really are, what's going on with us. If we always stay busy, it's very hard to see what the underlying assumptions, the underlying values, the underlying motivations, the underlying reactions and emotions that inform how we behave in our normal life, our activities. And even someone who does a lot of meditation every day, has regular practice and has all kinds of means of self-inquiry and learning about oneself, the experience on retreat is incomparable as a way of really putting a mirror to yourself and seeing what's really going on. It's a phenomenal aspect of discovery. Some years ago, there was a teacher in training who, part of what we do as teachers in training in our tradition is the teacher in training will sit in on interviews between a teacher and a retreatant to kind of see how those interviews are conducted and how just to learn from that experience. And there was one teacher in training who was sitting in on my interviews. And she was she is also a psychotherapist and had done many years of psychotherapy with clients. And after a round of maybe being present for 5 or 6 interviews of one day that I had, we kind of reviewed what had happened in the interviews, what we discussed and various things. And what she said, "I'm really amazed because the degree to which people are self-revealing in a 15-minute interview, it would take me in psychotherapy 6 months to get someone to be relaxed enough and trusting enough to be willing to tell me the kind of things they're telling you. And they don't even know you. They're coming, this is the first interview on the retreat or the second interview on the retreat. And you know, it's only 15 minutes. You know, here I can spend an hour a week and 6 months." And there's something about the degree to which the silence, the mindfulness, the self-inquiry brings forth that which is often very deeply buried in people. And then there's a kind of willingness to bring that into that very trusting environment, which the retreat is, and talk about it and reveal it. It's a fairly common remark that people will make that a 10-day retreat is sometimes worth, you know, and the various people give different lengths, you know, 6 months of therapy, or 1 week of, 1 year of therapy, or 2 years of weekly therapy, or something. I say that not as a way of any kind of way of being critical of psychotherapy and its power and its very great importance, but it's a common remark that people will make because of the great phenomenal power of that silence and that of the retreat experience. Part of the retreat experience is to slow down. And slowing down and becoming mindful, we begin seeing what makes us run in ways that are very hard in normal life. It's very hard to see, unless we slow down, it's very hard to see what we're running away from. And many people are spending much of their time running away. And you know, sometimes getting very busy, for some people, is actually a form of escape. And so by not being busy and just really being committed to sitting still and being present and not having distractions or entertainment or not superficially finding some kind of superficial relief when things get difficult, but just sitting there and really meeting what's actually going on will reveal deep, deep aspects of our life. I liken it sometimes to one of the last scenes, I think, of The Wizard of Oz. You know how the Wizard of Oz, they finally make it to the City of Oz? Is that what it's called, the City of Oz? Emerald City? And they go into the great court of the great Oz, and their booming voice, and there's this kind of big mask on the wall, and they're kind of, you know, talking very respectively, and kind of afraid, some of them, I guess, right, to go and talk with him. And they talk for a while, and then the little dog Toto goes behind and pulls a curtain. And there, behind the curtain, is this, you know, the little, you know, he's not such a big guy after all, is the great wizard. And he's revealed. And that is part of what happens on retreat, is that what's behind the curtain gets revealed. The director that directs the show, the values, the fears, the desires, the ambitions, the insecurities, that often kind of underpin our underpinnings for our personality and the ways in which we talk, the ways we relate to other people, the way we relate to ourselves, often is quite invisible until the curtain gets pulled. And the curtain will eventually get pulled if you do mindfulness practice, because the function of mindfulness practice is to not leave anything off stage. Everything gets put on the stage, because to have something off stage is actually takes a lot of effort and work. It's actually stress producing. It's actually a cause of suffering itself to leave the director off stage. And so to pull the curtain actually becomes a great relief, because at some point we can't maintain this the ability to always be doing the work to kind of keep the curtain pulled. So eventually the curtain gets pulled. Now, in this process of developing mindfulness, retreats also are a form of cultivation. That we put ourselves into a situation where the conditions are as optimal as it could be for us to develop our mindfulness, develop our concentration, develop our insight, develop our equanimity, develop our loving kindness, develop our compassion. There's many different factors that get developed as a person does a spiritual practice. And to have an uninterrupted opportunity to let some of these things be developed is very, very important to strengthen these capacities and potentials that we all have. There was one man on retreat who was struggling very much on the retreat. He had a lot of inner turmoil in his life, and it was very difficult for him to be present for his inner turmoil. And you know, I had a lot of meetings with him. We talked, and the retreat was very powerful for him because he couldn't run away from his inner turmoil. Nor in his normal life, he would have just gotten busy, and busyness he wouldn't have seen it. But if he stopped being busy, he had to really struggle with this, what was very painful within him. Various points in the retreat, he would be kind of despairing about himself. That, oh, you know, I shouldn't be here. It's, you know, it's hopeless for me. I can't really do this. I'm not a very good meditator or whatever. which is a fairly common judgment that people on retreat will sooner or later make for themselves, you know. And so I told them this story, or this analogy, that it's kind of like two people rowing a boat, or two different boats. And the first person is rowing this really placid alpine lake, where there's a wonderful current kind of through on the shore of the lake, and just kind of going with the current, flowing along. And every time the person drops the oar in the water and pushes, it kind of like just glides across the water. It hardly has to use any strength at all, because the current's helping them, the water is so calm and peaceful, and they just slide right along. And they can think, wow, I'm just the greatest rower that ever showed its face on the earth, you know, it's just so great for me, I'm just, you know, greatly accomplished, isn't this great? The second person, rower, is in a tempestuous storm at high sea, and there's winds howling and waves crashing and going up and down and whatever, and in order to make any progress at all on these seas, they have to really row hard, really pull hard, and they hardly make any progress at all. It's like, you know, an inch at a time, you know, and just like they hardly see it, right? And they feel like they're not getting anywhere at all. When both of them finally make it to the shore, which one do you think will have stronger muscles? So it's something like that on retreat. I'm not saying that retreat's all about struggling and having a difficulty, but I've seen often enough that people will come with radiant faces and quite calm and peaceful and filled with joy, which often happens on a retreat also. But they'll come to a conclusion about that, and they'll say, for example, you know, I really got it now. I think I'll be, you know, I really understood what meditation is, and I really, you know, really, you know, this is it. You know, I'm going to be blissed out forever now, and I'm really a hot meditator. And they really want the teacher to see them and kind of really prove, say, oh yes, you're a good meditator, and you know, whatever. And I'm very happy for them, and their experiences are partly the result of perhaps good work. But they come to the conclusion that it's partly they've done it, and it's you know, that they're still putting in good work. But actually, what they can be doing is coasting. Whereas people who are struggling on retreat and don't feel like they're doing it, getting much progress, getting anywhere, and they'll come and say, you know, I can't be mindful, I can't do this. Those are the people I know who are really putting a lot of good effort in, and they really have to be very mindful in order to stay present and not run away. And so you get the difference? Am I making a point well enough? We're such creatures of conclusion and judgment. We come to quick conclusions about where we're at. And if things are really pleasant, we think we must be pretty hot. And if things are unpleasant, we think we're pretty lousy. And but from the retreat teacher's point of view, I have this phenomenal respect for the power of the people who, for everyone there, but for the power of people who are struggling. And there's an odd thing that's very difficult for me as a teacher. When people are struggling in their practice, and that is that sometimes what's the wisest thing for that person to do is to struggle and struggle even more, and to come up against a wall that they can't pass through or can't break down or can't step beyond, and just keep banging their head against that wall with greater and greater and greater frustration until they finally give up. This was a pattern that I had on retreats regularly. And it was Zen retreats where there was very little instructions and chance to meet with the teachers. So I didn't have anyone trying to help me. So I would just find myself on retreat, and by the fourth day, my anger and frustration was so great that the only thing I can finally do was to admit that I was angry and frustrated and just give up. It was like finally, you know, I kept trying to find some way to practice, some way of being, some kind of understanding, some kind of something to solve the problem. And the only solution was to finally give up. And the only way I can give up was if I really tried really hard to kind of bust myself. And I think it's something like that that Thomas Merton has in mind when he says this. True love and prayer is learned in the hour when prayer is impossible and the heart is turned to stone. So that happens sometimes on retreat, that it becomes so impossible to do the practice that the only thing that's possible is to give up, and that's when it begins, the practice. And why that's difficult for me as a teacher is that people, it's very hard for me to tell that to someone. You know, I want to say something useful and helpful and, you know, whatever, and kind of make it easier for them. But to tell them, you know, tough luck, you know. You know, it's just, you know, or not say anything at all, just leave them alone so they just kind of, you know, continue on that course. To interrupt the course is actually sometimes doing them a disservice. And my only hope is that the person doesn't give up in the sense of leaving the retreat. The person stays present, tries their best, instead of giving up, surrenders finally, or somehow hangs in there until something breaks. Sometimes is the only way it's going to work for some people, or at certain points in their practice, certain times of their practice for some people. For other people, there isn't that kind of experience. There isn't that kind of experience regularly. For some people, the strengthening qualities that come as we cultivate ourselves on retreat are rather than meeting the great difficult tumultuous sides of their life, as they meet the angelic sides of their life. They meet which sometimes have been ignored and denied and haven't gotten a chance. And so people will come and discover aspects of joy, of delight, of peace, of calm, which maybe they have never really tasted before. It happened on this retreat. This person came and was kind of unsure of describing what her experience was. And initially she said, maybe I'm kind of numb. It was kind of, that's, you know, interesting. But eventually she realized she wasn't numb. She was calm, and she had never really experienced calm before. And so she was kind of unsure what to call it and what it could be. So the experience of peace, of being at peace. There was one woman who I wasn't seeing for interviews, but I was the only teacher in the hall during a sitting, so I think she came just to talk to me. And she came up to me in tears of panic and fear. And so she asked me if she could talk with me. So we went to the interview rooms and talked, and she said, I was sitting at outside on the picnic tables at Spirit Rock after lunch or during lunch, and I was just sitting there, and it was basically a very pleasant, very wonderful experience to be there. And she realized after a while that there was no self present. She couldn't find the self. You know, there was the experience of the sky and the trees and sensation sitting against on the bench or whatever, but there was no self that she could find. And at first, you know, it was, you know, without any reflection about it, it was just a wonderful experience. But then when she realized that she was having this experience, she got really frightened. And really frightened. And then as she came to meditate in the hall, she sat one sitting. And the next sitting, when I was there, I did a guided session of loving kindness. And that's why she came to talk to me. Because it made her even more frightened, because she tried to do the loving kindness. We always start with ourselves, doing it toward ourselves. And she couldn't find herself. She couldn't find anyone to do it to. Now, there's various kinds of ways of not experiencing oneself. But for someone who's a mature practitioner, and she was a very mature practitioner, practiced for a long time, it represents a level of trust where the normal constructions of how we think we should be and who we think we are is relaxed in that trust. And she had developed enough trust in her spiritual life to let go of all the various self-images that she held, that she used as a way of referencing herself to the world around her. She would, held a certain view of herself and projected that view to others, then others would relate to her. She had kind of a reference point for relating to the world around her and people around her. And without that construction, it was she didn't have any reference point anymore. She didn't know how to be, you know, orientation. Now, retreats are phenomenally safe places because you don't have to talk to anyone, no one's really asking you of anything, and you can just kind of, you know, you can be a no self on a retreat and you're just fine. But it can be very frightening, this experience, and so she was very frightened. So I had to talk to her for a while, and one of the things I told her was that fear is a very normal part of a spiritual practice, that if you're involved in spirituality, you have to sooner or later become familiar with fear. Maybe it doesn't have to be a great fear, but it has to be some level of fear. And because there is a degree to which we're asked in a spiritual life to let go of some of the normal ways in which we protect ourselves, with a self-image or with certain kind of structures we create around us, so that we can meet reality and meet life and meet other people in a much more direct way, unmediated by the protections that we have. And it's not so easy to let go of the protections. You know, that's why the protections are there, because we're afraid. And if we let go of them, then maybe we don't feel so safe. So I told her it was normal what she was experiencing, and I'd experienced that myself, and that helped her a little bit. And then I told her that some of the deep insights that we get in mindfulness meditation, like the insight into no self, that it isn't that insight is supposed to persist. It's partly that function of kind of experiencing no self there, as kind of a mystical experience of sorts. It's a beautiful thing to experience, but it's not going to last. Nothing lasts like that. And it, partly for her, was a function of the retreat experience, and that as sooner or later her normal constructions and ideas of self would come back, and that's okay also. So the no self experience doesn't persist. What persists is the trust that allowed her to drop into that experience. Some kind of level of trust in life that puts us more at ease as we negotiate and find our way through life. So the foundation for how we hold ideas and construct ideas of self and other, the foundation is not the foundation of fear, but rather is a foundation of trust. That helped her a little bit. The other thing that helped her a little bit was her eyes got really wide when I said this. I said, and one of the reasons you're afraid is you haven't been thorough enough in seeing no self. You've left something out. 10% of you hasn't paid it. You haven't directed your mindfulness at that 10% of you, which is afraid. And if you look deeply at the fear itself and the place in which the fear is coming, you'll see. Then right now you're still holding on to some subtle sense of self there. And if you're much more thorough and turn the mirror of mindfulness back at the fear itself carefully, you'll see that it also is impermanent, and you'll see it also, there's no self there. And you'll find that you don't have any place to stand on. And as long as you have some place to stand, you can get afraid. But if you have no place to stand on, you can't be afraid. There's nothing to be afraid of. It's kind of like the image, and this is for some people it's a very frightening image. I apologize. The image is that of falling out of falling through space, falling out of the airplane, and being really afraid that when you hit the ground, it's like you don't have a parachute, right? So it's bad news. And so you're falling and falling and falling and falling and falling, realizing you have no place to stand, nothing to hold on to, nothing to support you. And then finally you look down and you realize there's no ground. So as long as your mindfulness has to be really thorough and really look at everything and not leave anything out. And if you look at everything, you see there's no ground. And it's completely safe to be that exposed, that open, not hold on to anything. But it takes a while, and it takes a lot of trust. It takes some development of inner strengths to be able to have that kind of experience. And so part of the retreat experience, as I said, is a development of strength. There's strength of mindfulness, of concentration, of discipline, of honesty, of integrity, of self-knowledge, of generosity, of loving-kindness. There's a lot of emphasis in our scene on the development of loving-kindness. Some of the people on this last retreat, for them it was not a mindfulness retreat, even though that was advertised as being. But in consultation with the teachers, they were encouraged to make it a loving-kindness retreat for themselves, to develop loving-kindness. And that was really what was most needed for them, was for that particular stage of the practice, was development of loving kindness, and to develop some strength of that kindness and friendliness. So in the meeting of ourselves that the retreat gives, all these things can happen. There's the wonderful opportunities of de-stressing. There's the wonderful opportunities of revelation, of discovery of what makes us tick and what runs us. There's a possibility of cultivating strengths and factors that we're not so, which may be weak, and we can be developed spiritual faculties within us. And then there's a the possibility of discovering some really beautiful potential that we have, that isn't just simply developing strong qualities, but arise out of a trust when we no longer hold on to anything at all. We no longer defend ourselves to anything at all. The experience of retreat. And it's quite marvelous at the end of a retreat. You can feel it in the hall. There's a kind of a stillness that's made, a kind of shared stillness created by everyone there. A kind of tenderness that is born in that honest meeting of oneself, that honest allowing oneself to become calm and quiet and still. And we have to inevitably, always, at the end of retreat, remind everyone who's leaving the retreat that they're actually more tender-hearted, more open-hearted, more sensitive towards life and themselves, than more vulnerable than they think they are. And that it's very important to leave the retreat with some care. We didn't used to do this, but nowadays we always have a period of integration where we don't just simply ring the bell at the last, you know, minute of the retreat. We sit and walk and sit and walk and we sit and then we ring the bell. Okay, go home. We kind of used to do that in the early years, but it was such a shock for people to get up and leave. But now we have almost a full day devoted to slowly integrating and getting used to and now so we don't leave in such a tender-hearted place. But it's so sweet. It's so precious to be in the presence of so much tenderness and love and kindness. And that it gets born out of honesty, born out of self-confrontation, born out of being present for what's really difficult within us. It's born out of discovering the great peace and stillness that resides in each of us. It's a marvelous thing, the tenderness, the compassion, the love, the kindness, the trust. Some people then get addicted to retreats because of this. And it was a problem, much more of a problem in the early 80s and late 70s. The Vipassana scene basically only had retreats. There was no sitting groups like we have here, and it was just mostly, you know, the teachers had come back from Asia in the mid-70s, and they just started teaching retreats, and not just simply, you know, 10-day retreats, but I think some of the first retreats were 30 days. And then they started in 1975, they started doing a 3-month retreat. And so what happened was we got a large group of people who became retreat junkies. And they thought that's the only place where practice existed. And so they would be very good retreatants, be very, very committed and very much involved and, you know, very good practitioners on retreat. And then they would leave retreat and they'd fall apart. They wouldn't have a clue of how to bring their mindfulness and their practice into their normal life. And on top of that, they suffered even more because they had this notion that real practice was only on retreat. Real practice is wherever you happen to be at the moment. If you're on retreat, it's there. And if you're in your daily life, it's there. And there's no need to put more value on one or the other as being more real or less real. But to go back and forth between retreat time or I think it was the historian Toynbee, after studying some of the great religious leaders or founders of the world, said there was a common pattern of withdrawal and return that characterized great religious teachers. Withdrawal and return. Withdraw for a while and then return. And this moving back and forth, withdrawing for a while, going to retreat is kind of like a withdrawal. And in a way, we don't say this, maybe I shouldn't tell you, you won't go anything. But in a sense, the experience of going to retreat is becoming a temporary monastic. You're temporarily a monk or a nun, even though we never tell you that. Because you're living basically that monastic life. And then, so you do that for a while, and you come back. And you come back with whatever you've learned and cultivated there on retreat, and have that interact with your daily life. And you learn more. You learn more about yourself. You learn more how to be of service. You learn more how to be with other people. And after a while, and you're practicing with that reference point in a sense, and after a while then you maybe go back and withdraw again, do a one-day sitting or a weekend retreat or a longer retreat. And the two alternating back and forth, are very, very helpful for each other. They inform each other, they reflect each other, they support each other. In the same way, for example, that a daily sitting practice, going back and forth from sitting in the morning, and then practicing or interacting with your normal life, and then going back into the silence of sitting the next morning, going back and forth, is very, very powerful. So as a teacher, I think it's one of the most privileged, you know, jobs anyone could have, you know, to sit there and be a witness to such powerful sincerity, such powerful opening that people can have on retreat. And I'm very, very pleased that that there are such retreat centers at Spirit Rock and us, and we have such a, we're developing a center here in Palo Alto, right now a center without a center. I'm very, very grateful for this, and it's a wonderful, it's a really wonderful thing that we're doing and offering to ourselves and the world around us. So those are my thoughts coming out of the retreat. What are your thoughts or questions or concerns hearing all that? Yes?
Well, I just did a 9-day monastic retreat in Alvarado, and we had a reintegration period at the end. But I was surprised when I returned to find that my patients were shocked. You know, like going stepping back into my life, which I kind of cultivated a level of patience and equanimity and handling everything, I felt all of a sudden like I just didn't have it anymore. It's kind of like, you know, everything. I worked for, the county of San Mateo, and I just felt like everything was bureaucracy, and I just, you know, I had to keep stepping back from it, feeling like, you know, this was kind of good. What I brought home with me that, I mean, I don't know whether it was positive or negative. I mean, most of what I got out of the retreat was incredible, and, you know, I have no complaints about it, but it just kind of surprised me that somehow, something switched. It took me a whole week to kind of reorient myself to being able to work without, you know, feeling kind of a level of irritation. I don't know, I'm just kind of curious. Is this common, or is this, I mean...
Well, it can be. It's common enough that the integration period can be quite difficult for various reasons. In patients is an interesting one because certainly if we're feeling quite raw and quite very much more sensitive than usual, we're much more, because of that greater sensitivity, there can be a little bit less tolerance for things that we're much more tolerant of other times. But also, there can also be a different set of values that come from that deep sensitivity, that deep practice. And in order to have more patience in some situations in our society, there can be patience that comes from sharing those values, when maybe they're inappropriate values to begin with. So to somehow have our values shifted on retreat, there can also be a healthy form of impatience, or a healthy form of feeling, you know, this is not right, you know, I don't think I want to participate in this. You know, I don't know, this may be, if you have a, you know, a work that's, you, everyone's, you know, phenomenally competitive, and you were really competitive before, you can be you may be very patient with that competitive nature before you went on retreat. But if you no longer want to live in a competitive way, and want to live from other values, you can then find yourself being very impatient with that competitiveness in a way much more than you were before. So there can be both, the impatience can arise both out of the rawness that you have, and some of that will change as you become less raw and more stable with time. And it could also, some of that impatience might be because of a change of values. And that might, you might not want to let go of those, that change of vision of values too quickly. I'd rather see what you can learn from that. And does it make some sense?
Mm-hmm.
Does it speak well enough to your concern? Yes?
You raised my interest about the retreat and the benefits. Would you tell a little about the process? For example, if I'm going to confront myself, there must be some exercise or something other than just meditating and focusing on my breath. What is done? What happens? or is it just meditating? And second, Richard on Thursday recommended your August retreat. Maybe you could also tell about that. You said that would be a good one for beginners. So what are they?
Well, the primary practice is mindfulness practice, and what we learn on the retreat is how to bring mindfulness to all these aspects of our life that are coming up. So we learn how to be mindful of, certainly the breath is the foundation in a sense, but we learn to be mindful of whatever, the thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, our reactions, whatever's going on. And in that, in mindfulness is, if a person is dedicated to mindfulness, then mindfulness is enough. One of the very important aspects of mindfulness practice is that we're not actually trying to accomplish anything. And sometimes people have to be mindful of their attempts to accomplish something, to heal themselves, or to deal with some great complex, or to confront themselves in a way to have some great experience or whatever. The mindfulness practice unfolds peacefully, most easefully, when we learn that mindfulness in and of itself is enough. We don't have to have any other tools or agendas or activities. And in that sense, maybe my talk today is a little bit of a disservice, because maybe I gave the idea that you're supposed to be working, with all this stuff, personal stuff that might arise. It might arise, and then we bring presence to it. But it's the act of bringing presence that's important and most healing, not the act of necessarily solving them. A lot of what the teachers are trying to do is how to help people become more mindful of it rather than how to solve things.
What I'm confused about is, so far I've learned about just focusing on my breath and not thinking about other things.
Yeah, we don't particularly think much about things on retreat, but the mindfulness goes beyond the breath. We become mindful of our body and bodily experiences. We learn how to be mindful of our emotions and emotional experiences. We become mindful of our thoughts, not to think more, but just of the cognitive world itself. And so the whole, everything gets put on the stage. There's nothing that stays off stage. No one stays in the audience when you do mindfulness. Everything gets put on the stage to be seen clearly. So part of the instructions on a retreat is slowly kind of incorporating the bodily experience, the emotional experience, the cognitive experiences, so that you understand that mindfulness is basically to develop clarity to all our experiences, not just simply the breath.
You just said there are instructions on the retreat?
Yeah, oh yeah. So what happens on retreat is that they're silent retreats, so the retreatants don't speak. There's a teeny bit they might do. Everyone has a little work meditation they do to help run the retreat, anywhere from half an hour to 45 minutes. And there might be a little bit of talking just in terms of getting the work done with the kitchen or something that cooks. And then every other day there's an interview with the teacher, and you'll hopefully talk during those 15 minutes. Though sometimes people don't talk much. And then in the morning, every morning, there's a instructional sit where there's instructions given for that day, and the instructions build on themselves through the retreat and expand on the practice. And then each day, there's one period of meditation that's devoted to loving-kindness meditation, which is not mindfulness. It's a different kind of meditation. And then in the evening, there's a Dharma talk, a talk in the evening. And there's a schedule that people follow of alternating sitting meditation with walking meditation. Wake up in this retreat was at 5:15, then at 5:45 was the first meditation for an hour. Most of the sittings are 45 minutes, and interspersed with walking meditation. And there's a break after each meal. And but mostly, most of the day is spent doing walking meditation and sitting meditation, back and forth. Yeah, the mindfulness can be done in any posture at all, and there's four classic postures: standing, sitting, walking, and laying down. We in a sitting group like this, because of logistics, we mostly emphasize the sitting. And occasionally on Thursday evenings, I give instructions for walking meditation, but it's fairly occasional. If you come this Thursday to, I'm planning this Thursday to do it a little bit differently and to actually give instructions on all four of those practices, standing, sitting, walking, and maybe we won't do laying down. At least the first three. And the Vajrapani is a wonderful retreat. It's a 10-day retreat, and it's in the Santa Cruz Mountains in the Redwoods, a fairly rustic Tibetan retreat center that we rent. The meditation room is, it's very, very colorful in the way that, if you know anything about Tibetan Buddhism, it's kind of like, Catholicism, with, all these deities and colors, and so it's kind of lively. And there's beautiful woods, and we give instructions, and yeah, it's probably a fine place to come for someone relatively new. It's very, the weather can be very hot. It's variable, so it helps if you don't have a tremendous aversion to heat. But it can also be cold. This year it was really pleasant the whole time. We never know from year to year. It's kind of fun to be there. Take kind of minutes because I've been there now for. The room is another place, and the residence also a different place. So, and it's nestled up against these kind of oak hillsides, red grass-lined oak hills of Marin County, and. I just love the weather. Just every time you leave the meditation hall to go outside, it's like a different scene. Fog and misty and cloudy and raining and clear, and I have tremendous delight in being on the land up there. Yes, last one and we'll stop.
What you said about
I'll sit for 40 minutes then.
Yeah.
it's actually, for some people, it can be fairly common to have the first 20 minutes to be just settling in. And if they stop then they haven't really, it's kind of like they've done their work to prepare themselves and then they stop. But so if you sit a little bit longer, it can be helpful. And, another interesting thing about doing retreat practice is that you're doing the practice in a much more sustained way than you do at home. And so if you sit for a short period every day, there can be a certain attitude or understanding about what meditation is or what you're doing that is unproblematic. It's a little bit off, but it's unproblematic in the context of sitting for 20 to 40 minutes every day or an hour every day. Like for example, if you have some strong attachment that what meditation is about is getting calm, well, if you sit for 20 minutes every day, you probably get a little bit calmer than you were before, and that reinforces the idea that's what it's about. But if you sit for, all day and for several days, and you're attached to calm, that attachment's going to be hit you right in the face. You're going to see, wow, I didn't know I was so attached to being calm, and this is a problem here. And so you have to let go of that, and then you're happier and calmer. So thank you for letting me share the experience a little bit and talk about my very inspired 2 weeks at Spirit Rock. And it must have been okay since the three people from our Sangha who were there are here today. So apparently they didn't, you know, it wasn't too much. And also that the Donna baskets in this room are here, so if you can remember those today, that would be helpful. And thank you all.